OT After Dark is a podcast run by two occupational therapists and is for adults only. The views on this podcast are our own and are intended for information and educational purposes only. We believe that sex and sexual pleasure are a human right for consenting adults, regardless of ability, age, gender, or sexual orientation. We discuss topics that cover a wide variety of sex and sexual practices. To be true to our strong views regarding inclusivity, we use common and slang terms regarding sexual topics, which may be considered explicit. Listener discretion is advised.
We have exciting news to share. We recently partnered with DirectRec, a free app for OT practitioners, PT practitioners, and speech-language pathologists.
DirectRec helps clinicians to find peer-vetted products, and we recently have added our own recommendations of products on DirectRec for sexual health and wellness.
We helped DirectRec get a little extra sexy. DirectRec helps clinicians share products and other digital info, like YouTube videos and Google Docs, with their clients.
DirectRec helps you to track clients' follow-through on your product recommendations. So to start using DirectRec, click on the link on our website at otafterdark.com or in our social media bios.
Hi, I'm Kay.
And I'm JJ.
And we're both occupational therapists.
And we're here talking to you about sex.
And the pelvic floor.
And we are going global today. This episode, we have Janelle Galan from The Wild Orange Tree, and she's from Australia. And also Lindsay Kaup from eMotion Therapy out of Canada.
And we have a great conversation with them about how the pelvic floor ties in with occupations and occupational therapy, and a little bit about how you can incorporate pelvic floor therapy into your daily practice. So take a listen.
All right, so we are here today with Janelle Gullen from the Wild Orange Tree, and she's from Melbourne, Australia, and also with Lindsay Kaup from Alberta, Canada, with eMotion Therapy.
We got three time zones going.
I know. I'm proud of us being able to coordinate all of this. But they're both pelvic floor occupational therapists. So I'm going to let them introduce themselves. So Janelle, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your practice?
Yeah, no, thanks so much for having me. So yeah, I'm based in Melbourne, Australia. I do have my own private practice. I'm really helping women connect to their bodies so that they can navigate mothering transitions with self-love, confidence, and vitality. So I'm bringing together pelvic floor therapy, but also mental health. And I'm doing a lot of work around menstrual cycles as well, and how those longer feminine rhythms actually impact so much on our pelvic health and our mental health, especially as we're moving through mothering.
Excellent. Fantastic. Yeah. And Lindsay, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
For sure. So like you said, my name's Lindsay. I'm from eMotion Therapy in Alberta, Canada. And I own and operate eMotion Therapy, which is a one-woman women's health clinic, and really focusing on pelvic health throughout the population or throughout the lifespan. So we see right from pediatrics right through, I think my oldest client is 83. And so really just helping people to find joy and confidence in participating in their everyday lives. And if pelvic health is a barrier or something that's impacting that, then we need to help them find a way to work through that, work around that, and really come back to doing the things they love as much as possible and with as much confidence as possible. So a fun fact is one of my special niches is actually working with equestrian riders. So barrel racers specifically. That we've just launched an online program for pelvic health and barrel racing. So
very cool.
So yeah. Tell us, we get some questions about pelvic floor therapy and how you go from OT to pelvic floor or any other PT to pelvic floor. But how did you get there? What's the process to becoming a pelvic floor therapist?
I'm going to let you go, Lindsay, and then I'll come in behind because I've got a slightly different approach.
There you go, for sure. So for myself, it was just my lived experience. So I've been practicing as an occupational therapist for just under 10 years. And really, a little bit of my backstory was I was a high-level hockey player. I did a lot of Olympic lifting as a teenager. And until I had children and was leaking, so stress incontinence, I wasn't really thinking too much about it, but I had been leaking since I was 14, 15 years old. And it really, once I started to say like, okay, this is enough. I don't want to pee my pants at the grocery store. What can I do about this? And I started to research and I was like, there's all physios coming up, but all I'm seeing is in my mind, occupational therapy, right? So I just started to look and look and look. And at the time there really was not a lot of people practicing. Or that we could find practicing in occupational therapy and public health. And that was about 4 or 5 years ago. And so I did discover Lindsay Vestal and Melissa LaPointe, and that kind of springboarded different things. So I really wanted to think about how could I bring my profession into something that's solving a problem, not just for me, but for many other people. And as Janelle and I have chatted in the past, I lived 10 years of really painful sex and tearing every time I had sex. I didn't know that wasn't normal. And so I just thought that that was not something that I would want my daughters to go through or think about. So yeah, just our own needs usually bring forward our paths, right?
Mm-hmm. And how about you, Janelle?
Certainly my mothering experience brought pelvic health into the limelight. I had a birth injury with my first child. And I guess as I sought out some of those traditional routes for supporting my body to heal through that, it just didn't really sit right in my body. I felt like I needed a much more holistic perspective on healing, like how the mental health, the emotional well-being, the physical scar tissue, trauma, all those sorts of things, how they actually sat together. And as an occupational therapist, I felt so well placed to be able to pull all those things together for myself, and then also wanting to offer that to other mums. So I actually started off by doing some postnatal doula training, which really framed the context of that mothering rite of passage and the way that we can support women really well through that transition of becoming a mum. And then I've gone on to do a whole lot of other body work training. So I'm an Arvigo practitioner, which is very much looking at the organs, particularly the uterus and the womb, how the position of the womb in the body has a huge impact on our mental health and our emotional well-being, as well as our pelvic health. I've done Tammy Kent's holistic pelvic care training, which is bringing a lot of the energetic work into this, and how things like roles and habits and lineage all sit and play out in our bodies. And I've also done Lynn Schulte's birth healing training, which is again looking at the bony structures of the body and making sure that pelvis is actually come back from that birthing position, is well aligned, so that the organs and the muscles are then able to work to their optimal for pelvic health function, but again also really leaning into how that links to our emotional well-being too. So a lot of my sessions are very hands-on body work, helping women really connect into their bodies, learn about their bodies. It's amazing how little women actually know about their bodies, how many holes there are, where things actually sit in their body, what different parts might be, and then actually giving them some of their own skills in their own hands to work with their body and and really explore that pelvic space and how their mothering experiences are sitting in their body physically as well as emotionally.
I would love to talk about painful sex, but before, education-wise, what additional education did you guys need to start doing the pelvic floor therapy?
I advocate very strongly that occupational therapists don't need any further education. Yes, once you get into this space, there is so much that you want to go and do. It's like this course. You've sort of got to put a cap on it sometimes. But yeah, I really believe just with our core skills of being able to do task analysis, look at the role of the environment, the person, bring all of that together, like we are so well equipped to be working in this space and providing insight to what's actually going on for someone. And yeah, you find your niche and you go and explore certain areas. But as a starting point, you can just do this as an OT. I'm a very big advocate for that. Yeah.
What about absolutely you? Janelle. No, I 100% agree with Janelle. And it's actually really funny. This is the sticky note. And I know this is a podcast, so I'll read it out. But this is the sticky note on my desk, is how everything in OT school primed me for a career in pelvic health. Yeah. And so that's a future chat that we're going to be doing, because I absolutely agree. The foundation of occupational therapy, task analysis, bringing together biopsychosocial, bringing together your environment, cultural, social norms, all of that brings you to that basis of pelvic health. There is, obviously, you have to pay attention to your legislation and your kind of legal requirements as well. So for example, if you're going to perform internal assessments, you need to make sure that that's okay. And that you have appropriate training and competency. So I did take some additional training actually through physios, because I think right now in Canada, I'm the only therapist trained in internal assessment and evaluation of the pelvic floor. But that does not mean that I'm the only therapist working in pelvic health. And actually a colleague of mine, Lara DeRochier out of Ontario, and I put on a workshop last year for 50 occupational therapists on how to incorporate pelvic health and maternal mental well-being into their everyday occupational therapy practices. And we're actually going to be doing another webinar on that for the Canadian National Association next week. So it may be done by the time this is airing, but really it's just trying to look at how can you function. Mm-hmm. And, you know, toileting is an activity of daily living. Menstruating is a rhythmic activity of living, right? Mm-hmm. Sex is, all of those things. Walking, you need your pelvic floor to walk. Yeah, you need that for mothering. You need that to go to work. You know, so what, why is that any different than the hand, I guess, is usually what I come back to. There are different aspects and different components. And like you said, once you jump into pelvic health, you're in a black hole. You're not coming back out. There's so many niches in here.
There's so many ways I could go with that.
Well, very true. Oh man. But so you just have to jump with it.
I gotta go.
Right.
So let's talk about painful sex. Cause I think you made that point of, I think there's a lot of women who think it's normal. And so my disclosure, I had a hysterectomy a few months ago, and in some online support groups for that, I couldn't get over how many women were talking about how they have been having painful sex for years, for decades, some people. And it wasn't until they had a hysterectomy that all of a sudden they're like, oh, it doesn't have to hurt. Can you kind of talk about what are some of the things that are making sex painful for women related to the pelvic floor or anything else?
Yeah. I think we need to start at the point around sex education and what we're actually teaching young women right from when we're starting to talk about this, like sex ed in school. Like boys are learning about erections and all that kind of cool stuff, and girls are learning about periods. Mm-hmm. Like where is female pleasure in our basic sex education? How many young girls are told that, well, sex actually should feel really good, and this is something that you work on with your partner so that it's a mutually satisfying experience? So yes, I'm sure Lindsay can talk about some specific things going on there, but I think we really need to come from this social norm and what we're exposed to and what we're told about sex. And I see that massively, like as we transition into mothering, I think that's a massive shakeup of our identity. It's this huge biological rite of passage. And when we come through that, that can really open us up to the fact, well, I don't really like the sex that I was having. It's really not serving me, especially now that I'm this new invention of myself as a mother. And sometimes that wakes us up to the fact that sex can be crap and we're not happy with what we were getting. So go, Lindsay.
Yeah, no. I think, Janelle's nailed a lot of it. We need to go back and start again with some of the information and really what we assume women and men know about sex education, as well as what does that look like. And I think especially in the world of information and Google and Dr. Google, and think about, you know, the influences of the porn industry, the influences of, you know, marketing just in general about how people do that. I think that we have a lot around anxiety. I think we have a lot around performance anxiety from both, like any partner or any person involved with yourself, with others. And really, you know, from a biomechanical standpoint on the basis, a lot of women are carrying that tension and we carry our stress tension. And I'm speaking mostly to women because that's who I work with, but I'm talking across, you know, anyone, and everyone has a pelvic floor. We can really over-engage and hold that very tight. Mm-hmm. And I kind of talk about it like a triad. I see a lot of high-functioning athletes. I see a lot of high-functioning individuals and adults. I see a lot of people with trauma. So I think right now in the chronic pelvic pain kind of subset of the population, so we're talking about vaginismus, so involuntary contraction of the pelvic floor, vulvodynia or vestibulodynia, which is really unpleasant. It's just a chronic pelvic pain either in the vulva or in the vagina. And I think it's 47% of them have been subject to physical or sexual abuse. So we need to help people feel safe with themselves. We need to help people learn how to regulate their bodies and their emotions. And we need to learn how to, you don't even have to help people. We need to educate them on what does that actually mean. And a pelvic floor doesn't just Kegel and contract up. It needs to relax and open. It needs to relax and open for menstruation. It needs to relax and open for sex, for birthing, many different functions, right? So,
yeah,
you know, for myself, I really found that I was an over-engager. So I over-engage and held those things tight, and I had 90s in school. I was a high-level athlete. I really had to do everything the best. And all that did was just habitually train my musculoskeletal system to hold on. Mm-hmm. And then it gets painful. And now our alarm system goes off and goes, that was painful. And the next time I anticipate pain, well, guess what? It's painful again. And then we just start that vicious pain, stress, tension cycle, right?
Yeah.
So I think it can be the same as any other type of pain or fear, but there's so many components to that. And it really does, Janelle nailed it, come back to educating young people.
And I think it's a very interesting point. And I'm kind of curious as how it is in both Canada and Australia, because I think one of the big issues in the United States and in many of the states is that the law is teaching abstinence only. So there is no discussion of what is pleasurable sex or anything like that, because it's just legally not allowed. So what does that education look like where you guys are at?
Oh, it's a mixed bag in Canada. Where you are, what school system are you a part of, what religious beliefs do you hold? Like some people in certain faiths pull their children out of sex education. And really, I think we put a ton on the schools to do this, but I would really love to see this happening from parents to their children. Mm-hmm. This is your trusted person. You're a little bit more apt to have that candid conversation with somebody you trust versus your teacher and your peers who you really want to think you're cool, right?
Yeah.
So you're just going to kind of, you know, be the class clown or try and shrink into your chair. And I also don't know that schools are the safest place for people who have been, you know, through trauma to be talking about those things, because as much as I love teachers, my brother's a teacher. He brings me in to talk to his high school teacher or students about this, just because we need to know those basic pieces, but really it depends where you are. And are you in the public school system, the private religious school system? It's a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say it's very much the same in Australia, really mixed bag based on where you're going. But I think generally whatever's offered, it's definitely not embodied sex education. It's sort of very factual and looking at the diet. It's nothing about how this actually sits in your body and how it feels in your body. And so I think very similar to Canada is...
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a big lacking there. And I agree. I think home is the place where we need to be starting to talk about this. And like, I've got quite young children. I've got a 6-year-old and an almost 3-year-old. And being able to have really candid conversations with them about body parts and periods and birth and all these sorts of things. Like sometimes it feels really big and scary because it's certainly not the way that I was spoken to about these things. But my almost three-year-old daughter, she knows about periods, and she had a tantrum the other day that she couldn't wear a pad like mummy. So, but just that the fact that she's exposed to that, like I feel so honored to be able to bring that to her, because I think so many of us haven't had that real open, this is part of life, and eventually we'll get to those conversations about sex and pleasure and things like that. But that's really the place for it. But it's a huge transition, and it feels really huge when you try and step up to the plate to have those sorts of conversations with your child that isn't the awkward, am I going to have a chat kind of conversation that many of us experience. Just having it as part of life, and pelvic health function and sexuality, like that is a part of life. Like mothering and birthing, like that's just an extension of sexuality. So having that as just everyday conversation, I think is a shift that we maybe are starting to see a little bit. There's certainly some of my friends and other parents that I see, they're trying to move into that space, but we do need more of that.
Do you think there's anything occupational therapy practitioners can do to empower parents to have that conversation? Whether it be in from a just health promotion, public health standpoint, or working with clients with disabilities and special needs, like what can we do to empower parents to have those conversations?
The first word that pops into my mind is normalization. Mm-hmm. Like it is okay and normal to A, talk about this, B, explore this, C, really, you know, it's a discovered process for every person. Exploring your sexuality or your sexual preferences or different things, but really being able to, as Janelle mentioned, connect to your body and understand. And just the same as we use, you know, those senses to know when we need to go pee or poop, same thing. Like, what does that mean when I feel like this? Okay, so this is how that's connecting in my body. And I think for parents especially, you know, really... My 4-year-old knows the difference between a vulva and a vagina, and she will tell you, absolutely.
I love it.
You know, pronunciation, she thinks testicles are popsicles, but not in a good way. That's her own word she picked out. Sorry. But, you know, really starting that normal, so she has the language to have that conversation too. And then if we're thinking about children who maybe don't have some of those communication skills, how are they going to feel safe and comfortable exploring this, you know, whether it's showing, you know, so maybe we give heck a little bit too quickly to children who are, you know, pulling down their pants in a parking lot, but maybe they're just trying to figure things out. Mm-hmm. Yes, we need to learn cultural kind of appropriate norms as well, but what's step back instead of thinking right away, like, oh, that's bad. We don't show our privates. We don't do this. We don't do that. You know, what's that about for that kid, and what's coming up often and soon, and how am I supporting their exploration of that?
Yeah.
Through sensory, through mental health,
yeah,
all of those things.
Yeah. And I think we go about that, like just as we're doing an assessment or something, how's this part of your life going? How's that part of your life going? Or how's sexuality? Just normalizing it in that regard, but then also realizing that to engage with this, you need to be exploring it yourself. Like if yes. that parent that whoever significant other is being triggered by that conversation, well, it's looking at what's actually going on for you and what's been your experience of this. Yeah, and normalizing is a massive part, but recognizing that sometimes it's a really big body of work that people have to go through so that they can engage in those sorts of conversations.
Absolutely.
And I think OT provides quite a framework for doing that. Like, where does that come from? Their environment? Is it cultural? Is it political? Is it religious? What kind of internal experiences have happened there related to trauma, or what sort of activities have they engaged with in regard to sexuality? Like, how does shame fit into this? I think we've got some lovely models to really, really check in on all those different things that contribute to our experience of sexuality.
So let's get back into pelvic floor, the specifics of the pelvic floor. how does, like, the link, I'm guessing there's a link between orgasm and the pelvic floor. Like, what is that link?
So do you guys, well, you guys would know, but until I was probably 25 years old, I didn't know what the shape of the clitoris was, right? Like just something as basic as that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. You know, yes, there's definitely
put a diagram up on our website, on Instagram, Twitter for everybody. So everybody can be educated on what the shape of the actual clitoris looks like.
She's huge.
Pay attention. But I think, you know, in terms of the actual musculoskeletal pelvic floor, so that's three layers of muscles, right, that we're working with there. And then how does that actually create, if you want to talk, you know, kind of those forces, is that creating stretch and tension? How is changing positions even during any type of sexual encounter actually stimulating our actual clitoris or our intimacy? And I think the other piece too is that the pelvic floor is one of the functions is a sump pump. And it sounds kind of silly, but really it's meant to go down like a trampoline. And then as if your feet stick to it and come back up as a trampoline. So you're creating a ton of circulation. You're creating a ton of movement and tensile forces on all of the reproductive and sexual organs. So in both females and males, right? Or in anyone. So what does that look like? So if your pelvic floor is not moving, if it's all just held tense, or if you don't have the actual muscular strength or coordination or connection to actually move that pelvic floor, you're missing out on all of these different sensory experiences that are going to create and contribute to, and physiological experiences that are going to create and contribute to sexual experiences. So I think that's the big piece.
Mm-hmm.
The other piece is that most people have not a clue even, you know, what their own sexual organs look like. So we need to actually spend some time with a mirror. And that's something I encourage a lot in my pelvic floor education is you need to understand what things look like. You need to know what they feel like. You need to understand what your sensory preferences are. So even in the pelvic floor world, we're going to use things like sensory processing and avoidances and preferences. So we need to actually get in there and figure that out, whether that be, you know, through assessment or whether that be by yourself with self-exploration.
What would that assessment look like?
So one of my typical assessment looks like a really, really thorough history. We need to get really good in there. Then we need to figure out what's actually happening with the tissues and structures. Now, I consider this a piece of our assessment. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I get as much out of just chatting with the person and watching them do their activities that they're talking about. So whether it be pushing a stroller or jumping, right? Mm-hmm. But then we'll actually do a vaginal assessment. So a gloved finger in the vagina and actually assess, you know, what do those muscles feel like? Is there a difference left and right? You know, is the coccyx or the tailbone completely flexed from a birth injury, mm-hmm. right? Has a muscle torn away from the pelvis? Lots of women are living with levator ani avulsions and they don't even know that part of their pelvic floor is actually torn away from the bone. And they're wondering why they feel so, in their words, gapey or open. And they can't get that actual pelvic floor contraction they're looking for. And the other thing is who taught you to do a pelvic floor contraction? Because nobody taught me. That's for sure.
No.
Right? So what's that actually supposed to feel like from a physical perspective? Mm-hmm. And then how does that tie back to, how does that make me feel emotionally? Mm-hmm. What thoughts are going through my head? So I know Janelle kind of brought up the shame side and the different things. So our thoughts, our emotions, and our physical piece are all tied together. So I'll start mm-hmm. with that physical assessment because that's what people expect.
Mm-hmm.
But then we're going to take that a little bit broader and really push those boundaries as to what's going to bring them confidence and joy when they're in a sexual experience.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the ability to contract their pelvic floor, fantastic. If it just means that they feel comfortable and they know what's happening, great. That's what we're going to go for.
Now, when I'm doing my assessments, I'm also really interested in someone's ability to stay present in that pelvic space when we're doing that work. I think 100%. There's so much about our pelvic space that we dissociate from. Like we go to our gynecologist and get an assessment and whoa, we go out of our body while they're doing whatever they're doing down there, like due to trauma, all those sorts of things. So often there's dissociation during sexual experiences as well. It's not a part of our body that we often bring our breath and our presence and our attention connection. And that's certainly what I'm focusing on, and seeing if we can increase the range of access in that pelvic bowl. I'm very much looking at the energy and the emotions that come up for people. It's like, well, we've got a lot of tightness here. Like, what's that bringing up for you? And are you able to bring your breath and your attention down to that part of your pelvic space and stay with that? So, but we know that the brain is a really important organ in the body. We're starting to learn how our gut is a whole different, almost a second brain in our body. I really think the pelvic space is a whole other brain in our body as well. It kind of has a life of its own, and really being able to tap into the health of that space and the way that energy is sitting in there, the way that we can access that various part of our body, I think that's even a bigger piece than some of that physical stuff. When we realize how dissociated we are and how we can't connect with that space, bringing that presence and attention and awareness into that space can often really kick things on and bring the musculoskeletal system in on board again, and really allow women to access that function that should be there, but not coming at it from a biomechanical perspective. It's all those other things that are sitting in that space that they can be quite dissociated from.
Yes, I find the physical pieces is your access point. That's what people think is happening. That's what people can feel or see, or that's where dysfunction, I'm using air quotes here, is really, you know, showing up.
Yeah.
But usually there are layers and layers and layers behind that. So like Janelle said, during an actual internal assessment, which I must say is not 100%, you know, necessary. There are many people who are not going to want that. Mm-hmm. And we need to understand, like, you can do a ton without doing an internal pelvic floor assessment. Mm. That's just kind of a best information without trying to do some trial and error. Mm-hmm. But we want to have eye contact pretty much the entire time that we're doing the assessment, because that's going to tell us a ton. If somebody's wandering off in their brain, what is going on? So I love, Janelle, your explanation of that.
Just this whole conversation so far is making it so clear why this is an OT thing.
Yes.
100%. And you know what? The physical pieces, we're not saying those are not important. Absolutely.
Yeah,
we want that to work optimally, but
they're one piece in the 100-piece puzzle.
Yeah.
Everybody else needs to be on board. Otherwise, we're not going to see optimal physical function in sexuality, in toileting, in menstruation, in sex, right? So
it's so strange to me that more OT practitioners aren't doing this, because it was hard, and you guys know, like, I was hunting for a long time for a pelvic floor OT for the podcast, and I found you two, and I think you're it. But I was shocked at how difficult it was to find an OT. And I'm even more shocked now that I hear you guys talking more about it.
And I say this in a good way, but the physios are doing some of the hard research work for us and driving pelvic health towards occupational therapy, because more and more the evidence is showing up in the big studies that things like cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational interviewing, energy work, body work, these are all things that are highly effective in the pelvic health area. And, you know, maybe it's on my brain because we were prepping for this other webinar today, but the evidence is strong, very strong for occupational therapy in pelvic health. It just will not put those two words together in an actual literature search yet.
Yes.
But it is coming.
Word, yes.
This area is exploding in occupational therapy. And I say that very, you know, decisively. It is exploding. Yeah. And I think globally, the Australians are leading the charge, the Americans, the Canadians. I don't hear as much out of Europe, but I think we're just not connected to them yet. I think they're there.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think we're taking a lot of that, like the evidence that's been there around the physical aspects of it, we're really placing that in the context of what's actually happening for that person. And I'm working a lot with mums. And when Lindsay and I had a chat earlier today, we were talking about, there was a particular Facebook meme going around, and I can't remember where it came from or where to credit it from, but it said, there's no point being horny if you've got a lion chasing you across the Serengeti. And I think when we're talking about sex and mothering and perhaps a whole lot of other massive life transitions, yeah, we've got these women that are going through this massive identity change. Maybe they've got a birth injury or something physical going on. They're feeling really unsupported because, let's be honest, the structures in which as a mom now pretty part of that way that we used to do it. We've got women that are feeling really unsafe in their bodies. They're disconnected from their bodies, and they're just in survival mode trying to cope with these transitions. And then we wonder why they're not wanting to get horny in the bedroom. It's because I've got that lion chasing them across the Serengeti. And I think this is where occupational therapy can really bring that context to what's going on around this person. What are all these other contributing factors, and how can we bring our work around self-regulation and sensory processing and mental health, emotional well-being, all these sorts of things, and how that actually fits into that pelvic health space as well, and how that might be playing out in a meaningful activity such as sex. And I think also looking at what sex is, like there is a massive conversation, like we say sex and we immediately think penis in vagina sort of sex, and I think that comes up in that mothering space as well, that there's so many other ways to explore what intimacy could be with a partner, and different ways to learn about our bodies and other things that might actually feel really good or even better. And I think OT is so well placed to support women and men, any person, to look at that broader context of what's going on around their expression of sexuality.
And I love that you brought up the whole concept of that transition into a new identity when you become a parent and you go into that whole transition into parenthood. And I feel like a lot of times there's this societal expectation of what it should now feel like as that identity. Yeah. And it's not necessarily the same for everybody. And it can be.
It's very, not. It's we not also have
an automatic referral though.
Yeah.
Like have baby. OT referral,
right? That would be amazing. I love working with, I work with women from preconception as well. And the reason why I love doing that is these transitions that women go through, they're biological blood rites of passage. And our menstrual cycles are so crucial to cueing us into this longer feminine rhythm. Like our whole world is based around this masculine circadian rhythm where you work hard, play hard, you rest, you wake up the next day and you're the same. But women, we've got this longer infradian rhythm that runs through our bodies, our monthly cycle, this moon time cycle. And we see this playing out with our menstrual cycles that bring different energy for sex, for interaction, for socialization, for self-reflection, for rest. It really is a roadmap for our own self-care. But when we come to these larger mothering transitions, it's just a long extension of one of those menstrual cycles. Pregnancy is really that long autumn phase leading up to the bleeding time, and postpartum is the equivalent of a really long bleeding time. It's the equivalent of winter. It's a time that calls us to rest and nourishment. And if we're not used to leaning into those cycles when we get to practice them in our monthly rhythm, then it can feel really really out of place, and we don't know what to do with ourselves in that postpartum phase because we don't know how to rest. We don't recognize this is our body calling us to a time of nourishment so that we can then emerge back into those shorter cycles again. So I love working with women really from early on, and like how amazing if we could teach girls at 10, 11, 12, 13, whatever it is, when they're starting to get their periods, that this is actually a feminine rhythm that you can harness and you can lean into. It's not something that you need to try and hide or be ashamed of. It's actually something really powerful that links back to our sexuality, it links back to our activity, our engagement, all of these sorts of things. But it really is a roadmap for how we use our feminine energy to navigate those transitions. And if mothering is something that isn't on the cards or you haven't experienced, again, it's a roadmap for how we navigate perimenopause and intermenopause as well. I think this much bigger context that I love talking to women about and helping them understand that experience that they've got. So love to see them after birth, but even awesomer if we can see them beforehand as well and really cue them into some of these rhythms and how it is going to impact things like sex.
I am seeing, so you've enlightened me on two things now, just how perfect this is for OT and just how much of a public health thing it really is.
Yeah.
Yes. And like thinking about that, taking Janelle just one step further, is, you know, anytime that there's those transition points. So, you know, we're speaking specifically in terms of if we're speaking mothering and some of those things into, you know, female, but really anyone who's going through transition in their life. So I was just telling Janelle about a lady that I saw today who's lost her husband, and that could be anyone, right? Lose their partner. And now she's trying to enter a new sexual relationship for the first time in 30 or 40 years. Like she's in her 60s. What does that mean? And how do I, things are different. Like we had a set pattern with my partner, and what do I do now? Like I'm not in my teens or early 20s or whenever that might look like the first time around. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole new complexity to that of relationship and confidence and being comfortable and accepting of your body and your sexuality in those later stages of life just as much as early on, right?
Do you have one more question?
Well, no, I did have a question. And how often are you bringing in like the partners into this?
So
if there is a partner.
So you know what? Yeah. And sometimes people will want their partner involved. Most times people will not. They feel really, you know, quite closed about this still. I guess I'm a little bit jealous. My husband owns a mechanic company. Well, hey, everybody in the world shares about his mechanic company and they say how great he is, and yada, yada. Like, nobody shares about him. And they don't, you know, oh, Lindsay's a great pelvic therapist. You know, they might in talk, but like Google reviews, I think I have like 2. Right.
Even though we've been, I have a friend that's going for pelvic floor therapy, and she posts, and she does advocacy work. Working on her social media. Like it's
awesome. It's coming, right? But just trying to look at that. And the partners piece coming in, I find it's really, really helpful in my practice in chronic pelvic pain. So in pregnancy, in kind of education, we need to show up and show people how they can be supportive and educate and do different things. And they're kind of expecting that, you know, prenatal classes, different things like that. Maybe not to the extent that they should in quite the way that we hope they will. But really in those chronic pelvic pain, like vaginismus, we are seeing a big shift. And I'm starting to see partners, not many, but some, who will come in individual and really want to have that conversation around, I don't know what to do because my partner and I can't participate in what we thought we would. So what else does that look like? And how do we still have a flourishing relationship in intimacy without some of those pieces? And then coming back to, and I love talking vaginismus a little bit, but some of the protocols that we give people with dilators and stretching and different things that can really feel traumatic, to be honest. And they're very clinical, traumatic. It's like, really, I'm having pain inserting something into my vagina, and now I'm going to insert and increase the size so that it stretches. Well, yes, there is a piece to some of that, but we need to also look bigger than that. And so the partner's understanding as well around what's going to be safe, how do we support, you know, what are the thoughts going through your partner's mind? What are the thoughts going through your mind? And even just that basic communication, you know, I can't read your mind and you can't read my mind. So let's have a conversation about this and create a sense of safety and intimacy.
Yeah. Now back to the story of people not shouting about what we do. My son had to go to school and say what his mum and dad did for work, and he said, "Oh, mum, I just said you work in childcare because I didn't know how to explain what you do." I don't know where he pulled childcare from, but I think that's a little bit indicative. But I haven't worked with any women and their partners yet, but I'm also seeing a lot of mums that I guess it's the well woman kind of category, if you want to call it that, where they're really recognizing that there's something else going on in their body, and they're really wanting to explore that pelvic space for themselves, I guess, as a self-care practice. They don't necessarily have a particular diagnosis. It's just, I just want to know what's going on in this space and just connect more into this space. So for those sorts of women, it's been something that's really their own journey, and then we'll talk about how they might share that and what impact that might have with a partner later on. But I think bringing the partners into that space, whether it is skilling them up around those conversations and what might this actually mean and what might you want to communicate to your partner, or actually having them in the session together.
I wish actually both of you guys lived closer to me so I could schedule sessions with both of you.
I know. I want to see Janelle too. It's all good.
Can we do a Skype session? Like, is that a possibility?
And it's really interesting because I do pelvic health sessions via Zoom. So I offer that to women. It's obviously a very different kind of space because we can't do that internal work. Like a lot of my sessions are extended body work, and that can be extended internal work, extended external work, really look at what's going on. But there's also a whole piece around headspace and we can look at how you're using your body and those sorts of things online as well. So that can feel a little bit strange, like, well, how can you deal with pelvic health online? But I think you've had experience with that as well, Lindsay, but there's so much in this conversation before you get to, well, let's actually have a feel what's going on. So
yeah, absolutely. And we're starting to see referrals from physios come over. So as I've attended trainings and got to know some of the other physios and really networked, because in my area, that's who deals in pelvic health, mm-hmm. is usually a women's health physio. And so now they're starting to see the value of sending over a referral, maybe to myself versus a psychologist, mm-hmm. because I can speak the pelvic health language, but mm-hmm. also support them in terms of that mental health or a traumatic birth, or, you know, just even working with the understanding of chronic pain and different pieces there. So that's how I've been using that. Now, we still have rules and regulations around who we can see. So I can only see people via telehealth in my province. But here's where the shift to that education piece is. And Janelle and I have both been kind of eyeing up for the last year or two, is the fact that you can provide education anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. You can't establish a therapeutic relationship over certain geographical boundaries, but you can provide education. Mm-hmm. And so creating just basic information or education packages or webinars or courses, online courses, to really get people to start talking that language and achieve that base knowledge, mm-hmm. is really what we're looking for. And then they can then take that into a session with a pelvic health occupational therapist or a physiotherapist in their own area. And have a better understanding. And so that's what I'm doing with the barrel racing. And I know Janelle's been doing some with menstrual health as well. And there's no limits to creating more knowledge in this area.
So to kind of close things up, if for anybody listening right now that's thinking, I really want to do something, even if it's just a small part of their practice, what advice would you give to somebody for just like where to start? One small area you can start with.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking occupational therapists?
Occupational therapy practitioners. Okay.
Well, I'm just going to throw it out there that we are doing mentoring.
Okay. I'm sure we've got emails about it. So. There you go.
Yeah, so clinical mentorship, like there is a couple different places. I know myself, I offer clinical mentorship around the world, just in terms of what occupational therapy can share. So they can always email us or contact us through social media, but also really looking, there's a lot of people already out there. So Lindsay Vestal offers an intro course in pelvic health in the States. Tiffany Ellsworth Lee just ran a wonderful biofeedback course also in the States. And I know across in Australia that you guys have really been amping up the education as well, Janelle, but I think you can start with kind of contacting any one of us, because we see the need and we want to expand and grow. This is a very collaborative versus competitive space.
Yeah. No, yeah. Hugely so. And I think the other thing to remember is like the largest majority of OTs, they're going to be seeing people with pelvic floors, because let's be honest, everyone does. Yeah. So even without additional training, just ask some of these questions. I know as you guys promote, ask about sex, ask about these sorts of functions, ask about menstrual cycles, ask about transitions and where you are in that. Ask about some of these broader roles that might be impacted by pelvic floor functions and transitions as well. We can always start the conversation, even if we don't necessarily feel equipped ourselves to take it to the nth degree. We can ask and just acknowledge that there's pelvic floor involvement here for almost everything. And yes. But even if we're talking about mothers and that women's health, like probably 50% of our clients, unless you're in a real niche sort of area, is probably going to be a woman that may well experience mothering transitions, or the other half is men going to be experiencing fathering transitions or sexuality transitions, partner transitions, all these sorts of things. We can just start by asking the question.
Mm-hmm. And I think Janelle and I can both send over to you maybe a couple of the key kind of foundational articles or blogs or different things where people might be looking for a little bit more information about occupational therapy, specifically in pelvic health. And I think that's where we started, and then kind of growing over that, right? And then creating a deeper conversation.
Well, that was an awesome, amazing conversation.
I could have talked to them forever.
I know, right?
It opened my eyes to a lot of information. For anyone that wants to find more information on what Janelle and Lindsay are doing, you can find Janelle on Instagram at The Wild Orange Tree, on Facebook at The Wild Orange Tree, and then www.thewildorangetree.com.au. And for Lindsay, her Instagram is at Emotion Therapy Pelvic Health. Her Facebook is Emotion Therapy, and then her website is www.e-motiontherapy.com.
As always, sex is an ADL.
Cheers!